Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 40, which I will call Ezekiel's Vision of the New Temple, Introduction. I'm going to give you a lot of introductory material before we start on the chapter, and the chapter you will see consists of a lot of architectural details, which I'm not going to read to you. So this will be a summary of chapter 41, along with a lot of introduction. We'll start with what John Gill says about chapters 40 through 48. He says that they are thought to be the most difficult part of the whole Bible. The Jews forbid the reading of it till a man is arrived to 30 years of age, and then he must expect to meet with things in it he does not understand, and which must be left until Elijah comes to explain them. Many Christian commentators have omitted the exposition of these chapters and all acknowledge the difficulties in them. Well, we're going to leap in where others fear to tread. We will invite anybody under 30 years old to listen to this, and we're not going to wait for Elijah to come back to explain it to us. But you can see that there's going to be a lot of difference of opinion on these chapters. So let's begin. First of all, let's point out that there are a lot of differences between Ezekiel's temple and Solomon's temple, and also between Ezekiel's temple and the tabernacle in the wilderness. For example, Ezekiel's temple didn't have an Ark of the Covenant. It had no mercy seat. It had no cherubim. It had no golden candlesticks. It had no showbread. It had no veil. As far as priests are concerned, there was no high priest. And also, there was a change in the order of priest. Used to be Zadok in the times of the kings. As far as ceremonies, there was no evening sacrifice. There was no Feast of Pentecost. There was no Day of Atonement. Now, not only was Ezekiel's temple lacking a lot of things in the old temple, Solomon's temple, Ezekiel's temple added things. For example, there were living waters, there were healing trees, there were suburbs through the temple, there was a new distribution of land, the city had a new name, and there was a prince, a secular prince. Lots of differences, and that's going to be important as we try to interpret what is meant by Ezekiel's temple. Now, here are some issues raised by Ezekiel's temple. First of all, when was the temple fulfilled? Now, here are several options. I've got seven options. Option number one, it was fulfilled, if you can call it fulfilled. Let's say it described the first and second temple as already built. Solomon's temple and Zerubbabel's temple. Solomon's temple, of course, was in the fourth year of his reign. He started ruling in 970, so we'll say roughly 966. Those dates are a little fuzzy. The second temple, the dates are precise, dedicated in 516 A.D., so we'll distinguish the first temple as Solomon's temple. The second temple we will call Zerubbabel's temple because he was in charge when the temple was being rebuilt. We will also distinguish them by date. Solomon's first temple, 966. Zerubbabel's second temple after the return from Babylon, 516. Now, if you hold to this option that Ezekiel has described a temple that matches the first and second temple, we must say there are some similarities, but the differences are overwhelming. I just listed them to you. Another example, the size of Ezekiel's sacred district around the temple. That district had a size which was beyond anything associated with Solomon's temple and Zerubbabel's temple. So we're going to throw out option number one. Now here's option number two is when Ezekiel's temple is fulfilled. This option says that Ezekiel's description is a description of the plan for Zerubbabel's temple, which plan was never carried out. It was never carried out because the builders did not have the vision for such a huge complex, or also because of the opposition from the surrounding pagans, but for whatever reason, it didn't happen. Well, there's a problem with this view, option number two. The problem is this, Ezekiel's vision was given as a prophecy, but it didn't come true, so he must have been a false prophet, right? Well, that's not such a rigidly correct answer, because lots of prophets prophesied things that didn't come true because those prophecies were conditional on obedience, and Israel often wasn't obedient. But anyway, that is one problem with that view, that this was a vision of the contemplated temple that was going to be constructed by Zerubbabel on the return of the exiles from Babylon. But another problem is Ezekiel's description of the division of the land was totally impractical. It could never have been fulfilled, as we'll see when we get later on into our final chapters of Ezra. Why would God ask the people to create such a situation that's impossible to carry out? So we're going to throw out option number two, that the vision was of Zerubbabel's temple as planned, and go to option number 3. This is the so-called tribulation temple. This is, of course, according to dispensationalist pre-trib people who say the church is going to be raptured out before the tribulation, which occurs before the millennium. And they have passages through the Olivet Discourse and Revelation, which I believe refers to the run-up to the destruction of the Zacchaeus temple. Solomon's temple is reconstructed by Herod, and it's not talking about the tribulation. So I'm going to throw that out just on theological grounds. Here's option number 4 as to what Ezekiel's temple was. This option says that Ezekiel was prophesying about an individual believer who is a temple. The problem with that view is that Ezekiel goes through incredible detail describing this temple, and why would you do that if you're just trying to make a simple analogy of a temple to an individual human believer? As one commentator says, to explain the tremendous number of details of Ezekiel's temple using allegory detracts from a disciplined interpretation of the text. We're going to throw out option number 4. Now here's option number 5. This is a future physical temple. I guess that really is the same thing as the tribulation temple, except a little bit broader. I probably should have included those two options together. Now futurists who hold to this, who say that Ezekiel is talking about a temple that will be built sometime in the future, are not united as to when in the future that is. Is it in the millennium? Is it in the final state? Many of them, as a matter of fact, call the temple the quote-unquote millennial temple, which I will not do. I believe in a millennium, but I believe in a millennium between the first and second advents, and I believe, as I'll show you in a minute, that this temple is referring to the New Testament church, which is in the millennium. But it's not the way the word millennium is commonly used. We say millennium now, and everybody says, the pre-mill millennium, way off into the future. So I'm not going to call it the millennial temple. I'm going to call Ezra's temple the New Covenant temple. But at any rate, going back to option number 5, the futurists who say this is mainly dispensationalists, say that it's a temple that's going to be rebuilt in the future. Now here is a gentleman, or actually a woman, named Rebecca J. Anderson, who raises the difficulty is when is this future temple going to be built, in the millennium or the eternal state, which comes after the millennium? She says this, admittedly, this is at first a difficult issue to resolve, for there are many similarities between the millennial kingdom and the eternal state, and the prophets of old did not always make a clear distinction between them. She can say that again. Ezekiel's writings by themselves were therefore insufficient to address the question, but when his description of the temple is compared to the last chapters of the book of Revelation, it appears that Ezekiel's vision concerned a millennial, not eternal state. Now that is an assumption that I don't think a lot of people are going to go along with. The reasons for this are, again, architectural, topological, and theological. Architecturally, the dimensions of Ezekiel's temple differ from those of the eternal city. Well, obviously, because those dimensions of the New Jerusalem are meant to be symbolic, just as Ezekiel's dimensions were symbolic. But, of course, dispensationalists don't like symbolism. They like to be literal, hyper-literal. Rebecca Anderson continues, topologically, the sea is described as bordering Israel in Ezekiel, but in eternity there is no longer any sea. Theologically, Ezekiel describes a physical Jerusalem temple in great detail, but according to John, in the eternal state no such place exists. In the New Jerusalem, the only temple is the triune God himself. Well, there, Miss Anderson gets into this typical dispensationalist, literalist, futurist problems of how do you interpret eschatological things. They're obviously meant to be interpreted symbolically, but they try to interpret things literally and try to compare them, and they end up in a bog, which I'm not going to get into. So that's the 5th option, that is a future physical temple. Here's option number 6. Ezekiel's temple is a symbol, not literal, but a symbol of the final state. Well, if you're going to hold to that, and I would say that's okay, but why not just make it a symbol of the New Covenant Church? Because the New Covenant starts when Jesus died, and it continues all through the inner Advent period till he comes back, and then after he comes back, the New Covenant keeps on going because the New Covenant is forever between Christians and Jesus. So we're going to take option number 7. Ezekiel's temple is a symbol of the New Testament Church. Now, as you could see as I went through those options, there was a tension between two ways of interpretation, a literal interpretation or a figurative interpretation. Well, let's look at some arguments that I have culled in favor of both sides of this issue. Is the temple literally or figuratively fulfilled? Now, in favor of a literal interpretation, I'm going to quote Rebecca J. Anderson again. She says, though this temple appears in a highly symbolic book, there is much reason to believe that it is an actual physical reality and not a merely spiritual phenomenon. Notice that Miss Anderson does concede that this description is in a highly symbolic book, and that ought to move most interpreters to say, well, then that means the temple is symbolic too. But she doesn't do that. She says it's physical for these reasons. Firstly, this temple building is described in precise detail rather than loose symbolic terms. Well, that's true. The exact measurements of the wall, the court, and the sanctuary, as well as all the other elements of the construction, are provided for the reader. What would be the point of such an exercise if the place does not actually exist? Furthermore, the description is intensely visual. Such painstaking point-by-point consideration invites comparison, not to purely symbolic visions such as the four beasts seen by Daniel or the scarlet woman of John's Apocalypse, but to the pentateuchal pattern for the tabernacle, an inarguably literal building. Most importantly, Ezekiel is told to describe the temple he has seen to the people of Israel, and if they are ashamed and repent, to show them the exact plans and measurements. Why? So that they may be faithful to its design. That is a pretty good argument, I must say. Here's what Adam Clark says in favor of a literal interpretation. As the prophet knew that the Chaldeans, that's the Babylonians, had utterly destroyed the temple, that was in 586, Ezekiel thought it necessary to preserve an exact description of it, that on their restoration the people might build one on the same model. So Clark holds to that view that Ezekiel's temple is a plan for how Zerubbabel should have rebuilt the temple. As to allegorical meanings relative to this temple, Clark continues, I can say nothing. God has given no data by which anything of this kind can be known or applied. And as to those who have labored in this way, perhaps Solomon's temple spiritualized by John Bunyan, is equally good with their well-intended inventions. Those who wish to enter much into the particulars of this temple must have recourse to the more voluminous expositors who on this subject seem to have thought that they could never say enough. There's an ocean of literature on Ezekiel's temple, folks. Well, Adam Clark believes in a literal interpretation. Now, let me give you some commentators in favor of a figurative interpretation of Ezekiel's temple. This is from John Gill. He focuses on the fact that there's so much disagreement between Ezekiel's temple and Solomon's first temple and Zerubbabel's second temple. Here's what Gill says. There are some who think that Solomon's temple, as it was before it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and as it was rebuilt by Zerubbabel, is here described, and that partly to let the Jews know what a glory to their nation they lost by their sins, and partly that they might have a complete pattern for the rebuilding of it, as well as to comfort them under its present ruins. Well, that sounds very strong as an argument, but here's a problem with this interpretation. There's much disagreement between Ezekiel's temple and Solomon's first temple and Zerubbabel's second temple. Ezekiel's temple was to be built at a distance from the city, several miles, according to some expositors, 10 miles, others 20, and by the best account, 27 miles, whereas Solomon's temple and Zerubbabel's were in Jerusalem. And in Solomon's and in Zerubbabel's temple, water did not flow, and it certainly didn't flow uphill as it does in Ezekiel's temple. Also, the east gate in Ezekiel's temple is always shut. Not so in Solomon's temple, the first temple, or Zerubbabel's second temple. Also, Solomon's temple, the first temple, and Zerubbabel's second temple were profaned and destroyed. Ezekiel's never was. In fact, God will dwell in Ezekiel's temple forever. In my opinion, those arguments are not only strong, they're dispositive. Now, here are some other facts in favor of a figurative interpretation. Some details are obviously stylized and figurative. For example, the geometrically symmetrical divisions of the tribal land. There's no way you can divide land up, given all the different land forms involved, into perfect parallelograms or rectangles or however they came out. We'll see that when we get there. Also, we have water flowing out of the temple, flowing uphill and violating the laws of physics, no less. That can't be literal. Now we have the words of a commentator, Daniel I. Block, who wrote the book of Ezekiel, chapters 25 through 48, which is in the New International Commentary of the Old Testament series. He wrote this in 1998. He notices that the furnishings in the sanctuary are absent. He notices that the new moon offerings are different, And here's a direct quote from Block. The apportionment of the land of Israel among the tribes to a large extent disregards topographic and historical realities. What is more, there is no command to build the structure. And besides, there is the omission of vertical measurements to consider. If that partial list weren't enough, he thinks that the contrast between the Mosaic rituals and those of Ezekiel challenge the most fundamental prophetic law of non-contradiction, since true prophecy must agree with Mosaic revelation. All right, we're looking at arguments in favor of a figurative interpretation of Ezekiel's temple. We've already mentioned argument number one. There's so much disagreement between Ezekiel's temple and Solomon's and Zerubbabel's temple. And argument number two, some details are obviously stylized and figurative. Those two arguments sort of run together. The reason there's so much disagreement is that Ezekiel's details are stylized and figurative. And argument number three, which also runs together with the first two, is some details are impossible to be literally fulfilled. Here's what John Gill says. The chapters relate to the gospel and gospel church state. I wouldn't use that terminology, but I agree with that. The chapters relate to the new covenant, the church. The gospel, which I am fully persuaded is intended by the city and temple, for that no material building can be designed, is clear from this one observation, that not only the whole land of Israel would not be capable of having such a city as is here described built upon it, but even all Europe would not be sufficient, nor the whole world, according to the account of the dimensions which some give of it. The circumference of the city is said to be about 18,000 measures in Ezekiel 48, verse 35, but what they are is not certain. Luther makes them to be 36,000 German miles, and a German mile being 3 of ours, the circuit of the city must be above 100,000 English miles. And this is sufficient to set aside all hypotheses of a material building, either of city or temple, the one being in proportion to the other. Now here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, and this is going to be a long quote, but I think it's worth it. The arrangements as to the land of the temple are, in many particulars, different from those subsisting before the captivity. There are things in it so improbable physically as to preclude a purely literal interpretation. The general truth seems to hold good that, as Israel served the nations for his rejection of Messiah, so shall they serve him in the person of Messiah, when he shall acknowledge Messiah. The ideal temple exists. The ideal temple exhibits, under Old Testament forms, used as being those then familiar to the men whom Ezekiel, a priest himself, and one who was delighted in sacrificial images, addresses, not the precise literal outline, but the essential character of the worship of Messiah as it shall be when he shall exercise sway in Jerusalem among his own people, the Jews, and thence to the ends of the earth. Now there, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown sort of answers the charge that this temple has so many details it must be literally fulfilled. He's saying Ezekiel's just using language that the Jews were familiar with. The very fact that the whole is in a vision, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, not an oral face-to-face communication such as that granted to Moses, implies that the directions are not to be understood so precisely literally as those given to the Jewish lawgiver. The description involves things which, taken literally, almost involve natural impossibilities. The square of the temple is 6 times as large as the circuit of the wall enclosing the old temple, and larger than all the earthly Jerusalem. Ezekiel gives 3.5 miles and 140 yards to his temple square. The boundaries of the ancient city were about 2.5 miles. Again, the city in Ezekiel has an area between 3,000 or 4,000 square miles, including the holy ground set apart for the prince, priests, and Levites. This is nearly as large as the whole of Judea west of the Jordan. As Zion lay in the center of the ideal city, the one half of the sacred portion extended to nearly 30 miles south of Jerusalem. That is, covered nearly the whole southern territory, which reached only to the Dead Sea, and yet 5 tribes were to have their inheritance on that side of Jerusalem, beyond the sacred portion. Where was land to be found for them there? A breadth of but 4 or 5 miles apiece would be left. As the boundaries of the land are given the same as under Moses, these incongruities cannot be explained away by supposing physical changes about to be effected in the land, such as will meet the difficulties of the purely literal interpretation. The distribution of the land is in equal portions among the 12 tribes, without respect to their relative numbers, and the parallel sections running from east to west. There is a difficulty also in the supposed separate existence of the 12 tribes, such separate tribeships no longer existing, and it being hard to imagine how they could be restored as distinct tribes. mingled as they now are. In other words, Ezekiel has the 10 lost tribes of northern Israel. They're found again, which is interesting since nobody has found them, as far as I know, even to this present day. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue. So the stream that issued from the east threshold of the temple and flowed into the Dead Sea, and the rapidity of its increase and the qualities of its waters, is unlike anything ever known in Judea or elsewhere in the world. Obviously, because water doesn't run uphill. Lastly, the Catholicity of the Christian dispensation and the spirituality of its worship seem incompatible with a return to the local narrowness and beggarly elements of the Jewish ritual and carnal ordinances, disannulled because of the unprofitableness thereof. Now, that's a good argument against the futurists who say the temple's going to be rebuilt. Why? We have the temple now. It's the Church of Jesus Christ. Why, in the far future, the millennium or the eternal state, would God go back to the shadow and the type when he's got the fulfillment, the reality, in existence in the new covenant? The temple of the living God is now the church of the living God. So that's another very strong argument against a literal fulfillment of Ezekiel's temple. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, a temple with sacrifices now would be a denial of the all-sufficiency of the sacrifice of Christ. He who sacrificed before confessed the Messiah. He who would sacrifice now would solemnly deny him. These difficulties, however, may be all seeming, not real. Faith accepts God's word as it is, waits for the event, sure that it will clear up all such difficulties. Well, now he's starting to hedge a little bit. They are, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Perhaps, as some think, the beau ideal of a sacred commonwealth is given according to the then-existing pattern of temple services. I don't believe that for a minute. Which would be the imagery most familiar to the prophet and his hearers at the time. The minute particularizing of details is in accordance with Ezekiel's style, even in describing purely ideal scenes. The old temple embodied invisible forms and rites, spiritual truths, affecting the people even when absent from it. So this ideal temple is made in the absence of the outward temple to serve by description the same purpose of symbolical instruction as the old literal temple did by forms and acts. As in the beginning, God promised to be a sanctuary to the captives at the Kabar River, that's where Ezekiel is, so now at the close is promised a complete restoration and realization of the theocratic worship and polity under Messiah in its noblest ideal. Well, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, for the most part, say, as all these other commentators say, that it can't be literal. There's too many differences. Even some dispensationalists favor a figurative view. Now, here is a quote from John Wickham, the famous Genesis flood guy. I think he was a dispensationalist. His book, I think it's a book, not an article, The Millennial Temple of Ezekiel 40-48, An Exercise in Literal Interpretation. That sounds dispensational. The Millennial Temple, he calls it. But he's complaining because some of his dispensationalist brethren are bailing out on a literal interpretation. Here's the quote from Whitcomb. Dr. J. Sidlow Baxter, for example, tells us that the main meanings of the striking symbols are clear. The various cube measurements symbolize their divine perfection. In the description of the sacrificial ritual, we see the absolute purity of the final worship. Whitcomb continues, we are also very disappointed to see that even Dr. Harry Ironside, and of course Dr. Harry Ironside is a well-known dispensationalist, Dr. Ironside fell into the same spiritualizing tendency. That word spiritualizing is used as a pejorative by dispensationalist writers all the time, as if taking something symbolic is some kind of sin. Okay, well, I think as we compare the arguments, I think the figurative arguments are much stronger than the literal arguments. Now, a third way, besides strictly literal and strictly figurative, a third way Ezekiel's temple could be interpreted is that it was partly literal and partly figurative. This is a compromise view. This view says that the literal, precise details actually could have already been fulfilled in Zerubbabel's temple, leaving the rest of the obviously spiritual details to be fulfilled later. We don't know how Zerubbabel's temple looked finally, but it could have been built according to Ezekiel's plan, so this argument goes. The reason we don't know how Zerubbabel's temple looked is because Herod added so much to it that he covered over Zerubbabel's original temple. Now, another way that this argument is stated is that Ezekiel's temple is not really fulfilled in Zerubbabel's temple, but it's fulfilled in Solomon's temple. And I don't see how you can say that. There's so many differences, it's not even funny. But Adam Clark suggest this. He says the Temple of Jerusalem lying in ruins when Ezekiel had this vision, the Jews needed consolation. If they were not promised a restoration of the temple, they would not feel so great an interest in returning home. It is thought by some that no model of Solomon's temple had remained. To direct them, therefore, in the dimensions, parts, order, and rules of their new temple might be one reason why Ezekiel is so particular in the description of the old, to which the new was conformable in figure and parts, though inferior in magnificence, on account of the poverty of the nation at the time. Whatever was august or illustrious in the prophetic figures, and not literally fulfilled in or near their own times, the ancient Jews properly considered as belonging to the time of the Messiah. Well, using Occam's razor on that, you've got a complicated argument, partly literal and partly figurative. I think we ought to go with either literal or figurative, not both. Now, I have given you ad infinitum almost, the differences between Ezekiel's temple and Solomon's temple, but Clark says, that's true, but there are many details that are similar. Now, Clark gives some of the similar details. On comparing the Book of Kings and Chronicles with this prophet, we shall find the same dimensions in the parts described by both. For instance, the temple, or place which comprehended the sanctuary, the holy place, and the vestibule or porch before the temple, is found to measure equally the same both in Ezekiel and the Kings. In both temples, we see two courts, and a one for the priests, and a one for the people. Granted, okay. Clark continues, so that there is room to suppose that, in all the rest, the temple of Ezekiel resembled the old one. Well, that's a supposition. Ezekiel's description doesn't say that. And that God's design in retracing these ideas in the prophet's memory was to preserve the remembrance of the plan, the dimensions, the ornaments, and the whole structure of this divine evidence. All speculation. And that at the return from captivity, the people might more easily repair it agreeably to this model. Well, what Clark is saying is, well, yeah, there's some differences, but there's some similarities too. So Ezekiel was really talking about a restored temple in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel's temple. That's like saying, well, there's some similarities between a typewriter and a word processor, but the important thing to notice is that they're the same. All the differences, well, who cares? I'm not going to go there. I'm going to say that it is this description of Ezekiel's temple. It is a figurative one meant to symbolize the New Covenant Church. As we go through the description of the temple, we're going to see so many obvious spiritual references. For example, the water coming out of the temple, is that physical or is that literal? Living water? As it goes down, it rises in height, which shows the kingdom of God is expanding. It goes down toward the Dead Sea and encounters some dead fish which come to life. You see what I mean? Now let's look at a theological problem if one assumes the temple is literal. Don't the restored sacrifices in a restored literal temple trench upon the uniqueness of Jesus' sacrifice? Well, yes, they do. But the book of Hebrews says the sacrifices have been done away with, yet Ezekiel would have them back in his temple. Now, here's how the defenders of millennial sacrifices, so-called, answer. They say the sacrifices in Ezekiel's temple are not efficacious sacrifices. They are merely memorial sacrifices. Just as they say, the Lord's Supper is a memorial looking backwards to Jesus' sacrifice. In other words, the Lord's Supper looks back to Jesus on the cross. The bloody animal sacrifices in this so-called millennial temple are looking back to Jesus' sacrifice. Now, I'm no theologian. I was green as grass when I first read that argument, and I remember thinking, you got to be kidding me. So the dispensationalist futurist argument continues, just like Mosaic sacrifices weren't efficacious. They were rather typical. They looked forward to Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, which was efficacious. So Ezekiel's sacrifices will look backwards rather than forwards to Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. Well, there's a simple answer to that argument, as sophisticated as it might sound. This is from Curtis I. Crenshaw and Grover E. Gunn III in a book called Dispensationalists Today, Yesterday, and Tomorrow. I'm going to give you one sentence from this book. The problem with this is that Ezekiel's vision refers to these sacrifices literally making atonement. If you will read in Ezekiel 45, verses 15, 17, and 20, we will see the Hebrew word kafar, which means to atone. Now, to atone is not to memorialize. To atone is to efficaciously take away sins. Why would we need that when Jesus has already done that on the cross? Now, let me hammer that point home, because this is a very weak argument. a chink in the armor of the dispensationalist. What is the meaning of atonement? Here's a quote from Paul Martin Henneberry in a blog. He says, the Hebrew word kafar in most cultic settings means, quote, making atonement. The prophet employs the piel, the intensive, as if to make this point clear. Moving on along the same line of this argument, is it reasonable to suppose that memorials are necessary when Jesus is physically present in the millennium, according to the millennial view? Why do we need a memorial of his sacrifice when Jesus is right there? Continuing on in the same vein, the book of Hebrews says that the sacrifices are to be done away with. What does done away with mean? They're gone. That book never says they're coming back. Now I have a quote. Unfortunately, I've lost the citation, but this is a quote from a dispensationalist, or at least a proponent of millennial sacrifices. I assume he's a dispensationalist. He says it seems bizarre to have these sacrifices again. Quote, if at first the suggestion that the blood sacrifices in Ezekiel's temple serve a purely commemorative purpose seems bizarre, and then he goes on to defend said millennial sacrifices. Well, yes, it is bizarre. Now, here is another author who is cited at www.tentmaker.org. The author is unknown. This author claims that Ezekiel specifically tells us that the sacrifices are efficacious. Quote, the sacrifices there specified were not at all for a remembrance or a memorial, but were for the very different purposes of sin offerings, trespass offerings, peace offerings, etc. Also for cleansing the house, making reconciliation both for the princes of Israel and for the people, and the like. All the five offerings of the Levitical system are mentioned by name in Ezekiel, chapters 40, 42, 43, 45, and 46. And provision is made for sprinkling the blood of the sin offering upon the corners of the altar, upon the post of the house in court, in order to cleanse them. In a word, the sacrifices are the Levitical sacrifices, and they are expressly declared to be for the identical purposes thereof. So not only do we have, in Ezekiel's temple, blood atonement, but we have all the other rituals of the Old Testament. Really? We're going to restore that law which was done away with. So I think I've made my case pretty clear that this temple is a symbol of the New Covenant Church. So now we will begin. I'm going to go over the first four verses, and then I'm not going to read the rest of the chapter to you, 45 verses of architectural description. In the 25th year of our exile, Ezekiel begins, at the beginning of the year on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the fall of the city, on that very day the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. In visions of God, he took me to the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain on whose south side were some buildings that looked like a city. He took me there, and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. He was standing in the gateway with a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. The man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and pay attention to everything I am going to show you. For that is why you have been brought here. Tell the house of Israel everything you see. Now, verse 1 tells us that this new vision of Ezekiel is in the 25th year of the exile. The exile began, the first exile, when Jeconiah, Jehoiachin, was taken captive in 597, and that's when Ezekiel was taken to Babylon. 597 minus 25 years, the 25th year of the exile, puts us right around 572. Precept Austin has 573. They're always a year behind, using a different dating system probably. So roughly, I'm just going to say 572. This is about 20 years after his first prophecy. The first prophecy was in 593 or 592, and this is 572. 572 was about 12 years after Ezekiel's last prophecy against Gog. This new temple prophecy was given on the 10th of the month. There's much inconclusive debate on whether it was the civil or ecclesiastical year that this month occurred in. The 14th year, that matches 586 minus 14 gives you 572. That matches. On the very day the hand of the Lord was upon me, he took me there in visions of God. He took me to the land of Israel. Now, this isn't a vision now. Ezekiel didn't actually go to Israel. And in the vision, God set Israel on a very high mountain. Now, this is similar to other visions of the kingdom. John, the Apostle John, was on a high mountain when he saw the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven. Revelation 21, verse 10, and he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem. Jesus was on a high mountain when he was shown all the kingdoms of the world that could have been his. Matthew 4:8. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory. And of course, Jesus resisted the temptation. So the kingdom is seen from a high mountain. Mountains in the scriptures are often associated with good spiritual events. Mount Sinai, the law, Sermon on the Mount. That was a mountain. The Garden of Eden was on a mountain. All the rivers flowed out of the Garden of Eden. They had to flow downhill. Jesus, when he comes back to the earth, will return to the Mount of Olives, if you take that literally. So mountains are closer to heaven. So Ezekiel has his vision on a mountain. Now, what mountain was this? Well, I'm sure it was no particular mountain that was meant. John Gill agrees with that. However, Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, no, it was Mount Moriah, because that's where Solomon's temple was built, and this vision is about a temple. I don't think so. I think it's just some particular mountain. They look south, Ezekiel and the man of bronze, and they see what looks like a city, and it's actually the temple complex where Ezekiel's temple has been built. Why to the south? Because Ezekiel is approaching from the north, because everybody that comes from Babylon comes from the north, as I've stated many, many times. Because of the geography, you can't go due west from Babylon to get to Israel, because you're going across a desert. You have to go to the northwest up the Mesopotamian Valley, and then as the Euphrates River bends to the northwest in eastern Syria, you have to cross the Euphrates River and come on down south to Israel. Now this man that's mentioned in verse 3, his appearance was like bronze. This man is obviously the Messiah. He's the owner of the city and the temple, actually. That's appropriate if the Messiah is going to be the architect of the Church of Jesus Christ, which this temple will symbolize. They have measuring instruments, the man and Ezekiel do, or at least Jesus does. The Messiah, the man in bronze, has a linen cord and a measuring rod. He's the architect of the New Covenant Church, and so he's going to show Ezekiel how it's going to be built. Now, the man of bronze was standing in the gateway. That's the gateway to the city, the northern gate of the city, say Barnes, Pool, and Pulpit, the east gate of the city. According to Cambridge, there's a split of opinion on that. Doesn't really matter. I take it to be the north gate. So they're looking down on the temple complex, going from north to south. Now, the man of bronze, Jesus, has a linen cord. That's a measuring instrument for long distances, and a measuring rod. That's for short distances. These are architectural tools. The man said to me, said to Ezekiel, Son of Man. Why did Jesus call Ezekiel Son of Man? Well, God's been calling Ezekiel Son of Man all the way through the book. Here are two options. The first option is Jesus was trying to keep Ezekiel humble. As John Gill says, Son of Man was a title often bestowed upon him, upon Jesus, upon Ezekiel in this prophecy, and here used to put him in mind of his origin and descent, and of his meanness and unworthiness, thereby teaching him humility. I disagree with Gill on that. I think that Jesus was making Ezekiel to be a type of the New Covenant Jesus when Jesus comes into the world. Son of Man was a messianic title. It comes from Daniel 7:13. I continued watching in the night visions, and I saw one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father, and was escorted before him. Unfortunately, in my previous chapters, for about 11 dozen times, I said that this phrase, Son of Man, came from Daniel 7:14. I was quoting from my memory. I was off by a verse. My bad. Now, Jesus adopted the title Son of Man because in the Old Testament, it was clear that Son of Man referred to the Messiah, and so Jesus adopted that title so that people would look upon him as the Messiah. Now, God and Jesus here, the man of bronze in the vision, they knew that Jesus would do this, that Jesus would be called the Son of Man in the New Testament, and so the man of bronze calls Ezekiel Son of Man to make Ezekiel a type of Jesus. I like that theory. Here's some parallels between Ezekiel and Jesus. Both preached against the rebellious house of Israel. Both predicted the downfall of the Jews' temple. Ezekiel prophesied that the Babylonians were going to take it down, which they did in 586. Then the temple was rebuilt, added on by Herod, and then Jesus in the Olivet Discourse says that the restored temple, the temple of Herod, is going to be destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. He said that on the Sermon on the Mount. He said that in the Sermon on the Mount. Now in verse 4, the man in bronze, Jesus, tells Ezekiel, tell the house of Israel everything you see. Now Clark says that the reason that Jesus tells Ezekiel that is so that the Jews would know how to rebuild Solomon's temple. I don't believe that. Clark assumes that this was the purpose of Ezekiel's temple vision, but I don't believe that. I believe that this was supposed to be a highfalutin symbol of the New Covenant Church, and the people of Israel needed to know that. Now, verses 5 through 48 describe the temple, and I'm going to not read them to you. I don't want to put you to sleep, but I'm going to describe the temple very briefly using pictures, models that I have in my notes, which of course you cannot see, so we'll do the best we can. In verses 5 through 16, we see the east gate described, the east gate which goes to the outer court. So there were two courts. And then in verse 17 through 19, we have a description of the outer court. And then in verses 20 through 23, we have a description of the north gate. Verses 24 through 27, we have a description of the south gate. So let's stop and look at my model here. We see a big perfect square. That perfect square has 30 rooms arranged around the four sides of the square. My particular model has 8 rooms on the north side, 8 rooms on the east side, 8 rooms on the south side, and 6 rooms on the west side, for a total of 30. Now, the scripture doesn't say what was in those rooms. I assume they're just storage rooms for the implements needed to carry out the temple sacrifice. Now, that square with the 30 rooms is the outer boundary of the outer court. As you go into the outer court, you have a small rectangle. That's the inner court. It has a low wall around it. In the middle of the inner court is the big temple, very tall. Looks like a shoebox with a rectangular solid in front. That's the gateway and the porch of the gateway into the temple itself. But now this inner rectangle, which is the inner court, it had 3 gates. Distinguish these gates, of course, from the gates to the outer court. These are the gates to the inner court. You have a northern gate, you have an eastern gate, and you have a southern gate. There is no western gate. That's the back of the temple. Now, verses 28 through 37 describe in great detail those gates to the inner courtyard. Now we have rooms for preparing sacrifices. They are in verses 38 through 43. Now, here is a structure that is not seen in Solomon's or Zerubbabel's temple, so I need to describe this. Think about the little rectangle that is the inner court. It has a low retaining wall around it. Let's start with the northern side first. Think about one shoebox laid across the retaining wall of the inner court. And in this shoebox, there are 3 layers, 3 stories. Priest rooms are in those stories. Then think of a shorter shoebox moving away from the temple toward the north, placed at a small distance away from the large shoebox. That's also 3 stories tall with priest rooms. But it's a short shoebox because on the western and eastern ends of that shoebox, there is a square, a 1-story room, so it doesn't reach to the top of the shoebox. And so the easternmost square was the chamber where the burnt offerings were washed. And in the westernmost square is the room where priests boiled and baked, the priest boiling and baking room. So these are the priest quarters. Now, you've got the same sort of structure on the southern side of the inner court also against that retaining wall. Now, not only do you have these priest quarters, but you have side chambers alongside the temple itself, which just looks like a big rectangular solid, even bigger than the priest quarters, the 3-story priest quarter shoebox. This looks like an even bigger rectangular solid, the temple does. And alongside those walls are temple side chambers, both on the north and south side. Now, moving along in my description, in the inner court, right in front of the eastern gate to the inner court, right in front of the eastern portico that gets you into the temple, you have an altar of sacrifice. And just to the south of the gate that goes into the temple and the gate structure, which is very, very tall, by the way, abnormally tall, you have a stream of water coming out from the temple from under the wall of the inner court, the lower restraining wall, and the water runs right on out the east gate. Now, the gates that I told you about that were to the east, north, and south of the inner temple, you imagine these gates as being very, very high. The structure around the gates looks like a cabinet of a PC, personal computer, the exact dimensions, very high, with arches cut into the sides. Now, also in the inner court, as you cross that retaining wall, in the southern and northern corners, you see two inner court chambers for singers. Now, I hope you could see by now, this is not much like Solomon's Temple. It's close. I shouldn't say close. It has some similarities to it, but there's so many differences. And then in verse 48 and 49, we get to the temple itself, and we are now finished with Ezekiel 40. And we're now prepared to go to Ezekiel 41, which I will call Vision of the New Temple Part B, and we will continue with its description. Hope to see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.